last pieces of this to cover this morning. I think you indicated the hope of being done in an hour, and I'll try and do my part to make that happen, although we'll be happy to answer any questions that you or the committee may have. I don't know if you want to spend any time particularly on program priorities. Our program and is pretty well focused and I think fairly self-explanatory. We implement our priorities principally through our planning program. You've heard about our technical assistance both at the regional level as well as the state specialist level, and also through our grants programs, TGM, General Fund, and Federal Funds through the Coastal Program. If you have any questions about priorities, I'd be happy to address them. They're under tab B in the details. Otherwise, Mr. Chair, just also point out we also have submitted, and I wouldn't spend any time on our House Bill 3182 reductions. Again, unless there are any questions about those, they're behind tab C. I will just spend a few minutes on the quality improvement and efficiency concepts, because those were a particular request of the Legislative Fiscal Office and the co-chairs in our budget preparation. Those you will find on page 23 behind the overview tab. And this is a department, Mr. Chair, that particularly in the first couple biennia of this decade sustained substantial reductions in its budget. As you know, we're general funded, not fee funded, so we live and breathe on the general fund appropriations and the legislature. So this department has been about economy and efficiency for several biennia, and I think we do that fairly well. In fact, I'm very proud of what we've done in the way of actually getting more done with declining resources over the first couple of biennia, and then, of course, taking on the new responsibility of ballot measure 37 on top of our core functions. We've identified in the memorandum that begins on page 23 several efforts that we have made and are currently engaged in to economize and provide more efficient services. One, and it's our first one, I'm very proud of the budget and fiscal restructuring that we have done in the department. I think this department did have a rather checkered past in two or three biennia ago in terms of its budget and fiscal management, and we do point out in our first item on page 24 of the memorandum that we've developed a model now that actually is being implemented by other agencies as they look at the department and how we have restructured our budget and fiscal operations in the department. So I think we have turned a big corner in that respect, providing transparency and accountability in our budget and financial management. Also, it's a small thing in the big world, but in our world, it's significant centralized purchasing practices that we've implemented to economize how we go about purchasing requirements. Our supplier has commended the department for its efforts in that regard. It certainly makes it more efficient to provide services or supplies to the program. Something, again, that we've implemented, and I'm very pleased to see that that's working well. Of course, our Measure 37, that's been about economizing and getting to efficiencies, and that from day one. Every time we see a standard issue or development in our Measure 37 claims processing, we try to implement that in a template. So that as our claims reporters and writers go through their Measure 37 claims, we're spending less time on composition of reports and more time on review. And so we have a substantial set of templates that we have developed for our Measure 37 claims writers to increase their efficiency. Also, a big investment in the last couple of biennia, this last one in particular on information technology. This department was woefully behind on information technology. I was shocked when I came to it 3 years ago to see the inadequate capacity that we had on information technology. We have made information technology a focus for the past 3 years, and of course that makes us easier to access for our local government and private sector partners and anybody else who wants to know what's going on in the department, but it also has made us more efficient as an agency, bringing our field offices into real-time contact and access to our main databases and all of the things that you would be surprised that were not available 3 years ago. Also, we are improving our GIS system capacity, again, for a land use program. GIS capacity, I think, is critical to know how we are doing and also to allow local governments and those that we work with to know what the state of affairs is in the land use program across the state. That is ongoing as well. But lots of work being done on information technology to make our work more efficient, both internally and externally. And then also, you've heard about some of the things that the Land Conservation and Development Commission has done in rulemaking and policy to try to streamline our processes, particularly I think you heard from John Van Landingham yesterday, what we did with the Urban Growth Boundary Rule, how for the first 30 years or so of the program, urban growth boundary expansion was really an ill-defined process for local governments. It led to a lot of inefficiency both for local governments and for us in reviewing their work. We've developed now a rule that that is the first of a two-part process of laying out how you do an urban growth boundary amendment so that local governments can follow the roadmap to get them from start to finish. And also included in that significantly is a series of safe harbors so that if a local government in amending their urban growth boundary chooses to adopt certain methodologies or assumptions, those are deemed to be satisfactory, those are deemed to comply with law and are not reviewable for appeal purposes. And so we believe that local governments will find those rules much more accommodating to their processes in adopting urban growth boundary amendments. And that's significant, as I think we touched on earlier in our testimony. We're reaching a maturation in the planning process where urban growth boundaries that were established at the early part of the program now are filling up. And we're seeing more and more cities moving toward urban growth boundary expansions. So we think we're ahead of the curve here in trying to develop a process that they will be able to use in a streamlined way to accomplish those boundary amendments. Also something we've done, it's a little thing, but I'm proud of it. It's item C under 5 on page 25. We have developed an introductory guide to land use planning for small cities and counties. As we mentioned earlier, and as you know, a lot of our small cities and counties just don't have full-time planning staff. The person that is the planner may also be the one that reads the meters on Wednesdays and does dog licenses on Thursday afternoons. That's just the reality in a lot of our small cities. And as we have heard in conversation with the committee, also there are complexities to the land use planning program that we expect local governments to know and abide by. And so to try and meet that, we have developed a guide to land use planning. It's a basic guide for non-professionals to show them what the basics are and to help them through the basic processes, including in this guide forms that the local governments can use to do their own to use in their own planning departments and process locally. So we're hoping that that will be well received, and in fact, by early responses, it has been well received by local governments. And then simply as we close on item number 6, a number of efforts that we are undertaking on an ongoing basis with local governments, just through our technical assistance to help them reduce costs and increase their efficiencies in navigating the land use planning program, working with the economic revitalization team. We are meeting on a joint basis on a regularly with the senior staff of the Oregon Department of Transportation and also with the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department so that we are staying in contact at a staff level so that our staffs in the field are aware of what each other is doing and trying to avoid those unhappy circumstances where you have agencies that cross purposes with each other in the field that can slow things down and frustrate local communities. Mr. Chair, that's a brief overview of that memorandum. I think you have a couple of questions, and I'll stop there and be happy to answer questions the committee might have.
Representative Garrard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lane, as we've listened to a lot the last couple of days,
it becomes, I congratulate you on working on the streamlining and the education process, because it's obvious that there's a real problem with not only some of the rural communities, but I think some of the larger ones too, in that our land use laws are so complex that they need grant money from you in order to figure them out and make proper application. That's a bothersome thing in that regard. And I'm not quite sure whether the angle of approach is to streamline and educate, or whether to continually be looking at trying to simplify the application processes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Girard, it's a good question, and I think the answer is probably yes to both in terms of simplifying and streamlining. Certainly, that was an emphasis in the what brought about the Senate Bill 82, the Big Look Task Force. How can we undo some of the complexity in the system that just has evolved naturally, not through any perverse intent, but just naturally over 34 years of the program. But by the same token, and I think we've also had conversation about this in earlier testimony, planning itself is complex. Apart from, you could take away the rules, and you wouldn't have a simple program. You wouldn't have simple planning at the local level. In fact, you may have, over time, even more complexities, because if you're not planning, you're coping, and that means you're catching up all the time. We certainly heard testimony yesterday from Ontario, from folks who live on the border between Idaho and Oregon, where Idaho does not have a planning program anything like what we have, and it's not nirvana. So I think it's both. It is a matter always of trying to make our rules clear and transparent, and as easy to administer as possible, but also recognizing that the problem isn't just with rules. The problem is the fact that it's that living in a community and planning for a community, planning for infrastructure, roads and services, where homes are going to go, where industry is going to go, schools, those are all complex. And you could take away the rules and it wouldn't be a simple program. So I think it is, you do have to do both.
Thank you. This department under your leadership is doing an excellent job, and I'm very pleased that you're aware of this and are working.
Thank you. Yes, we sure are.
Thank you. I did not give you a softball.
I'm done. Okay. That wasn't a softball.
No, but I'm not going to give you a softball.
Okay.
You're planning for continuous improvement and efficiency. So let me give you two different scenarios for what happens to your department over the next 4 to 5 years. We come to a reasonable compromise on Measure 37, and all parties are maybe not entirely happy, but they're not terribly displeased, which is usually the definition of a reasonable compromise. The Big Look comes back and reports to the legislature, and all the legislators step back and they say, this is a revelation. We've never thought of anything like this, and we're going to adopt it all, and we're going to resolve all these things, versus we don't come to any reasonable compromise on 37. The Big Look goes through the 4 years, comes to a legislature that's not particularly receptive to what they're proposing. Outside groups are not particularly receptive to what they're proposing from maybe both sides or multiple sides. How do you plan for your department under those two different scenarios?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, that's not a hardball, that's an army of hardballs. Let me just kind of, I don't have a quick response to that. First of all, I guess I would say that in the short term, we're planning on current law, which is Measure 37 is with us, and nothing has come back to us yet from the Big Look. And so certainly for the coming biennium, we're planning right now on continuing to implement ballot Measure 37. And I think I remain hopeful that this session will produce something on that score. Let me start with your first scenario. If it does, then I will be happy to offer up as much of the policy option packages we have in our budget request as we can to accommodate whatever new reality may be in Measure 37. So I'd be happy to give that back. That's easy. And then in 2 years, if the Big Look comes back, I think the future of the department really is going to depend on what sort of legislative priorities and directives are implemented as part of the big look. I mean, keeping in mind that this department is just a reflection of legislative policy and direction on the land use planning program. It is a creature of Chapter 197, Chapter 215, and the other statutes that drive the land use planning program. So we will be whatever the big look creates in the way of an ongoing department. And I'm not in a position to reflect on that crystal ball. Let's assume if those things don't happen, Measure 37 will continue to drive significant budget needs, both for staffing but also more and more for litigation. That is the next big wave of Measure 37. We'll get through, in one fashion or another, the claims that are in the pipeline, probably within the next, we hope, 12 to 14 months or so. And that claims process, I think, will ramp down substantially when that's done. Litigation won't. Litigation is going to continue, barring some legislative intervention, for the next 4 to 6 years. So in that future scenario, Measure 37 will continue to be a significant and probably growing budget driver. And then if the big look does, I guess if their report comes back and it's not endorsed by the legislature, then we will continue to operate under the statutes that currently direct the department. I think at that point we would probably be inclined to undertake some of our own more intensive review of the program. I think you heard from Chair Van Landingham yesterday that the commission has taken a policy at this point of not getting into significant amendments to the land use planning program in order to defer to the Big Look Task Force. If the Big Look Task Force were to come back and the legislature were not to adopt anything, I think it probably would fall back on the commission to look at what its authorities would be to continue still to make some amendments to the program that get at the very direction that Representative Girard and I were talking about, trying to make it more rational, transparent, and easier to navigate. It's tough to say. It's a murky crystal ball that we have for the department for the next biennium or two.
Additional questions? Seeing none.
Okay.
We'll move on to the 2% reduction.
All right, Mr. Chair. The 2% reduction is actually summarized on page 37 of the overview that you have before you. This gets back again to the budget history of this department, going back to the early part of this decade. There were significant budget cuts made to the department, particularly during the 2002 special sessions. I voted for them, I'm sure. But they were dealt with primarily in the services and supplies area. As you probably know from looking at our organizational chart, we are not deep in positions. We have one farm and forest specialist for the entire state. We have one urban specialist for the entire state. We have our regional staff, three people that cover the entire eastern half of the state, that is east of the Cascades. We're not deep in our org chart, and so for positions, when we take reductions, it's difficult, next to impossible to go there. We're also not deep on administrative staff. Our folks run the photocopiers. We do our own printing. We empty our own waste baskets. It was kind of funny. It was my first 2 weeks or so at the department, and my waste basket was getting full behind my desk. And so I stepped out to my assistant and I said, do the DAS folks not know that this office is occupied now? My basket's not getting emptied. And she said, well, that's silly. You do it your own. You do it yourself. So we are not deep in administrative kinds of positions either. And so where we've taken it over the last several biennia has been in services and supplies. And frankly, we're just about to the limit there as well. We're doing, through our information technology improvements, as much as we can to go to paperless, and that has helped, but we don't have a lot to go there. We also are loath to propose reductions in our grants programs. As you've heard, our grant programs are the lifeblood to local governments, and we've done everything we can over the years to protect those grant programs, to maintain those dollars as available to local governments. And so in the addressing the 2%, the target for general fund came to us as $206,000. We looked first at landowner notification. That's a reimbursement program that comes out of ballot measure 56, through which we reimburse local governments for the cost of notices that they send, that they are required, that they have to send to landowners when decisions that changes in land use law may affect and reduce or restrict the use of property, impose restrictions on property. We think that in the post-ballot Measure 37 world, first of all, we haven't seen a big draw on that landowner notification reimbursement fund because you don't have a lot of regulations being enacted these days that are limiting the use of property. And so we have offered up a significant part of that Measure 56 landowner notification reimbursement fund as the bulk of our 2% reduction, taking the balance of what we think we can afford down to the bone in services and supplies. Caveat to that, that if either as a result of legislative action or some other force that we don't currently anticipate, if there should be something occur that does require local governments to provide landowner notification under Measure 56, we may need to come back and perhaps with the emergency board or the February session and take a look at that. But for right now, we think we can offer that up with some trepidation, but also probably the highest degree of comfort. And I would much rather go there than either staff or our grant funds that go out for general fund purposes. On the other fund target, you'll see we are requesting an amendment to that that came out to us at $19,352. If we do that, that's another $19,352 out of services and supplies. But we believe that as a result of policy action package removing $168,000 that's in empty other fund limitation, that we should be able to reduce that 2% target down to $1,771 that could easily be accommodated. I think we've had conversation with staff on that.
Representative Brown.
Lane, if the county stabilization fund is not renewed, what impact will that have on your agency?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gard, is that the federal fund, the
yes,
school
secure?
Yeah. Yeah. It won't have any direct impact on our agency. The impact that it will have, I think, is what you heard yesterday, in that that will it's a feedback effect. It reduces general fund support to local governments, makes them probably more dependent or more needful of state dollars to support programs that are imposed by state law on them. At the same time, at least in the counties, I think a lot of counties, their planning programs are largely fee-driven, and so they may have some capacity to insulate those programs from some of the reductions in the secure rural school funding because they are fee-driven and have the capacity to be fee-driven. But I'm sure counties probably don't have most of them don't have the capacity to do it all from fees. And so I think there will be a feedback there where as their federal dollars are reduced, they're going to be looking to every other resource that's available to supplement their general fund. And to the extent that general fund dollars at the county level in those counties that are most affected by the reduction in secure rural school funding, they'll be looking to the state, as you know, for human services, for roads, everything else that they're required to do.
Mr. Chair, just a comment. At least in Klamath County when I was a commissioner, the planning department was one of the few departments in county government that actually was profit-producing because of those fees. So ties in with what Mr. Shelley is saying.
I would guess also that for those counties that are in that particular circumstance that have chosen to pay some of the cost of the development applications through general funds, and there are some, and some for very good policy reasons have made that choice, that they would now move to covering more by fees, actually, just by actually necessity, not by desire. So
I would expect we would see that.
Okay. Anything additional? And all right. We'll move on to policy option packages.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I brought my deputy, Cora Parker, with me today. I'll acknowledge happily as probably more capable of answering some of your technical questions as we get into these. If you have them, I think our packages are fairly straightforward, so I'll try it. We have package 060, technical adjustments. Did you want to say anything about those? Just a technical adjustment package.
Land under notification was previously a separate appropriation. Sorry, for the record, Cora Parker, Deputy Director of the Department. Land under notification, again, was formerly a separate appropriation, somewhat because of the diminishing size, and you saw we're even recommending further reduction there with respect to the 2%. We've asked to move that into our regular planning services appropriation. We've had conversations with both budget management and legislative fiscal staff. I think they're supportive of that move. It's a zero impact to the agency. It's simply moving it from one budget unit to another.
Okay, number 070. This is the other fund limitation that I referred to in our 2% reduction conversation. This is an empty limitation that was previously in other funds, revenue source from Oregon State University, that is no longer available to us.
And again, those were funds that were anticipated to be available this biennium, largely for a special project that we would have worked on with the university system. The funding never came to fruition, so we didn't expend those funds in the other funds category this biennium either. It's truth in budgeting. It's not going to be there. There's no need for us to have the expenditure limitation related to it.
And then again, that gets to our request that the 2% other funds reduction be reduced accordingly, because these dollars were not in our budget and aren't in our budget. It was an empty limitation. Package 101 is Measure 37. What to say? We've had conversation about this. It is important to first understand that this budget was developed over the course of last spring and summer based on what we knew then. What we knew then was that there was more coming. We had no way of predicting the numbers of claims that we would be seeing that did come in during that period, late October to early December. That was above and beyond, I think, anyone's wildest imaginings as to the number of claims. Just to refresh you, more than the half of our total claims during the two-year period following the enactment, the effective date of LMH 37, came in during that last 6 weeks before the December 4 change in process. And as a result of that, has overtaxed our system based on current staffing levels to be able to move those out within the 180-day time frame that is provided in the measure. This package that is before you really is a continuation of where we ended the biennium, where we will be ending the biennium in terms of our Measure 37 division. And it does include not only the 16 positions that are indicated on the summary here, but it's important to note that of that $4.5 million, a significant part of that is for litigation expense as well. And I can tell you that it is several times a week that I get an email from the Department of Justice informing us of a new complaint. Either that or we're served at the department. Our folks know the process servers around here now by first name basis, and they're coming in on a regular basis. I always do want to qualify that statement because it sounds like, well, we must be getting it all wrong then if we're getting sued on all of these, but I'm still happy to report that we're being sued from all sides. In fact, we have one case going now that I think is sort of the picture-perfect illustration of where we are on Measure 37 and what it represents for us as a department and us as a state. It's a fairly well-known claim out of Lane County. It's known as the Wildish claim, decision we made granting a waiver. Mr. Chair, we're being sued by the claimant and we're being sued by neighbors, all out of the same claim. So that just typifies the litigation that we're seeing. coming at us for claims that we grant and claims that we deny.
My guess, quite honestly, is that for the claims around the metropolitan area, once they go through the process, you'll see more lawsuits.
Mr. Chair, that is a very good point. There is a second, I mentioned that litigation is a second wave. There really is a second part of that second wave, and you're right. And that comes from the development phase of these Measure 37 claims. Where we're seeing it, it's just now beginning to ramp up, but I think we'll see more of it, is on the LUBA track. As you know, about Measure 37, decision to waive or not waive is not itself a land use decision. That's specifically called out in the measure. However, when a claimant gets a waiver from us and from local government, and then takes that waiver and turns it into the county planning department with their planning, with their land use application, that does convert that into a land use decision. And we are in the process now of looking at local land use decisions that are being made implementing claims. And it's not surprising. There is at least a number of claims where we think that local development decisions may extend beyond the scope of a waiver that has been granted by the state. And in those cases, we are commenting on the land use decision at the local level. And I think we have two cases pending now before LUBA on those local decisions. Four cases. We have two more that will be approved, we expect, by the commission tomorrow. So the post-waiver development phase will be a second part of the litigation under Measure 37.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lane, there hasn't been much conversation in regards to compensation. But let's say the clock ticks out on the counties, clock ticks out on everything else. Lawsuits are filed. You indicated that about 90% of the claims are being approved at this point, leaving 10% of 7,000, which would be seven. And that's just the tip of the iceberg,
right.
not the detailed stuff. But what happens if, after all, everything goes through the courts, you have judgments against the state, against the counties, awarding a compensation piece? What do we do then?
Mr. Chair, Representative Girard, that may actually be a better question for DOJ. I'll give you what I think. And for the record, you will have judgments, assuming that the sort of doomsday scenario that we miss the deadline on several thousand claims. First of all, you've got litigation expenses right up front on those, because I would assume that most of those would proceed to litigation. I will tell you, if that were to happen, we would probably be in immediate contact and negotiation with the claimants to ask them to not file. We would continue to process the claims, although we wouldn't be we wouldn't have any control over that. If we're over 180 days, they have the right to go to court. So let's assume that most of them do, or at least a fair percentage of those. You've got litigation expense to begin with, and it would be expensive litigation, because in the litigation, one of the things that we would have to be addressing would be the actual reduction in value, which means we would have appraisers involved in each of those cases. And that gets very expensive when you bring in appraisers. Assuming that that we don't prevail in all of those cases, and that we're found, the state, are found to be liable for a money judgment. The judgment would be for the amount of the reduction in value of the property complained of in the claim. Plus, it would be for the claimant's attorney fees and costs. So if the claimant has incurred costs of an appraiser, we would be responsible for those as well. So there's another significant hit. That judgment would be a judgment against the general fund of the state. if we, and there's really no way to say what that dollar exposure is. I mean, if you were to look at the sort of taking the rough cut the way you proposed it and assuming that the dollar amounts are what the claimants say they are in the claim, and I think it's a dangerous assumption, it's potentially billions of dollars. But I wouldn't assume any validity of that number. That would have to be winnowed out on a case-by-case basis. I think you have a couple of risks. One, to the extent that that represents a liability of the general fund, it could put the legislature in a position of having to come back and actually appropriate money to pay those judgments. To the extent the state is not able or is just does not respond to those judgments, I think it becomes a risk to the state's credit rating, certainly, to have those unpaid judgments out there. And then, as I mentioned, I think in testimony yesterday or maybe the day before, if a judgment is not paid after 2 years, the measure says that a claimant gets to go ahead and use their property anyway, but the measure doesn't clarify that that de facto waiver then satisfies the judgment, and so that judgment liability may still be standing out there. It's a mess.
Thank you.
Is that a legal term?
It is a legal term. And so just to kind of wrap, not wrap.
Oh, we have one more.
Oh, okay, sir.
Representative Slam.
Thank you. On that same topic, you had talked about what we might need to get some appraisers involved at that point because it's dangerous to assume that the claimant's valuation is accurate. Do you know much about what counties are doing in that regard I know there's no standard valuation, that it's sort of on the claimant to say what their loss is, but do you know, are there some counties that are using appraisers, or are we largely relying on the claimants to tell us what they lost without us saying, yeah, okay, that's right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clem, to my knowledge, it's standard practice across the state require the claimants to establish at least to make the first statement of the alleged reduction in value. I think some local claims processes require, or at least the rules require, appraisals. I'm not sure that that is being honored in all cases, either by claimants or, in fact, by local governments that say that they have to have them, in part because the measure says that local governments can establish processes, but they can't deny a claim because somebody hasn't followed the process. So you have local rules out there that say, for instance, you have to pay a fee, but if the claimant doesn't pay the fee, the county processes it anyway. And I think that's probably the same on local rules that say you have to have an appraisal. So I think that for the most part, it is up to the claimant to go forward with something stating a reduction in value. And I will tell you that the state's process of looking at that has been to not validate that statement. We don't agree with the statement of reduction in value that comes in with every claim. We don't accept that. But we do look at whether there has been a regulation that has restricted the use of the property relative to how it could have been used when the claimant acquired their interest in the property. And in almost all cases, we accept that as substantial evidence in the record of at least some reduction in value. And since the measure doesn't include the concept of proportionality, saying that the waiver has to be equivalent to a determined reduction in value, once we establish that there is some evidence in the record to establish that there has been a reduction in value, the dollar amount really is immaterial to us. We go on with the question of waiver.
Mr. Chair, just for the record, doing the math in the meeting one night at about 6 p.m. on a Tuesday night, the 4 days in December, the claims then expire the first 4 days of June. There was $1 billion worth of claims each day for 4 days. So June 1, 2, 3, and 4, we will be potentially on the hook for $4 billion just for those 4 days worth of general fund payments if we lost in court.
Well, while it's unknown, my guess would be that because no one has been scrutinizing what the damages would be, that it would be a number significantly less than that. I mean, if I had 30 acres outside the urban growth boundary and I had a Measure 37 claim, I might say, well, Bridgeport would have located there with their $300 million in development. But that would probably be a fairly facetious argument because they wouldn't locate there. They'd locate at the intersection of major, at a major highway. So I think the process would be enormously expensive.
Mr. Chair, I agree. It would be less than $4 billion. It would also be more than we have in this package 101.
Well, yes.
that's the point we were getting.
You're bankrupt. I mean, that might cover your first hour and a half litigation. But yes.
Well, which actually, Mr. Chair, and not so much a question, but Mr. Shetterly deferred one question to DOJ and perhaps could have just as appropriately deferred it to his former home, since the legislature deliberately chose not to act 2 years ago when the voters approved Measure 37, which said government shall pay, and the legislature declined to appropriate any money to do exactly what the voters had told us to do.
Remember, we did not ask the voters, will you pay to compensate, which is the reality of who would pay.
Right.
Mr. Chair, it's a very interesting point. You know, sometimes we talk about Measure 37 as if it was an asteroid approaching the Earth. It's not. I mean, it is entirely in control of the legislature in terms of the future. That's a scary prospect. Speaking as a former legislator myself, that is a scary prospect. No, I mean, in terms of the responsibility that entails.
Well, I think, I don't know if anyone else is this. Representative Garrard and I share something. I don't know how many he sat through, but in a former life, in both local government and on the regional level, I sat through numerous four-hour land use hearings. It's something I do not want to go back to be quite honest. And
I share those dreaded moments with you.
Yes. We're now on to package 102, but okay. I did have a... let's see if... why don't you go through 102, and okay. Then I'll remember this other question
okay.
that I have.
Mr. Chair, package 102... It would be a limitation to receive federal dollars for continuation of the flood hazard map modernization program. The department is a partner with FEMA in its flood program. We provide consulting services, technical assistance to local governments to help them maintain plans that will comply with and make them eligible for the National Flood Insurance Program. FEMA has initiated a national effort to update its flood hazard maps so that and the critical importance of that is so that local governments, as they approve development applications, can know whether they are looking at development applications that are in a floodplain or a floodway. And those maps that local governments are working with, for the most part, are old and out of date. And the technology is pretty old and out of date, too. A lot of paper floating out there. FEMA is engaged in a multi-year effort now to support map modernization, both to update the information in the maps and also to put them into a GIS format so that they're accessible and usable. And so we are the agency that is working with FEMA through our staff to help implement that map modernization program. And this continues three limited duration positions with federal dollars for that map modernization program. Anything more to say about that? Okay.
Yes. Senator Nelson.
Just a question on the LIDAR. You know, we're talking about the Dogami issue. How does this fit in with the Dogami issue?
the DGAMI issue is the work that they're doing on LIDAR that I think we will later attempt to at least give them some seed money for this coming biennium. I think their target is going to be largely in the next couple of years, coastal area, plus maybe other local government entities in other areas that are willing to help in terms of paying part of the cost of the work being done. Does this fit into that at all? Or
I don't know that there's a direct link. We certainly are working with DGAMI and any other agencies that it makes sense in coordinating with them to the extent that the efforts DGAMI is doing with LIDAR, if they can overlay what we're doing on map modernization, I think certainly we'll have those conversations. But as far as these dollars go, I think regardless of what DGAMI is doing, we still have an effort here to move forward.
I think the portion that was interesting, and maybe Senator Nelson wanted to comment on this, about the LIDAR is that even in built environments, you could actually basically determine what the exact elevation was of the underlying surface. So it might give you some clue that in a flood environment, what areas would be most impacted. So
certainly one of our partners in those efforts.
The question I have, this is an absolutely hypothetical question, because I do not anticipate that when this budget comes back that we will have any additional dollars for local grants. But in theory, if you had additional dollars, in terms of the grants that you're giving out, I mean, you had some that were just broadly based, so much per jurisdiction, relatively small grants, and then you had targeted grants, and then you had some specialized grants for people going through periodic review. If you had additional funds, where would you place them? Where would you suggest they be placed?
Mr. Chair, it's important, first, to set the stage for that. We have a grants advisory committee that actually includes representatives of local government, cities and counties, special districts, and a few other stakeholders. They help establish the priorities for the department, so it's not entirely my decision. It's the grants committee. And so we would, first of all, take input from that grants committee to establish the priorities. Based on having said that, so that it ultimately it's going to be their decision to guide us on that, based on what I think I know about their about priorities out there, more grant dollars in would translate probably to two areas: economic development and periodic review. That's probably where the highest priorities would go. That wouldn't be exclusive. I think there'd be more dollars for a whole range of things. But in terms of what the priorities currently are for the Grants Advisory Committee, it is. It's in economic development planning and periodic review, and I would expect that those would probably remain as priorities. So the bulk of any additional dollars would go there. I would say, too, that we do the grants, the special funds for the gorge counties, and an increase in the grant funds might also be reflected in some proportionate increase to those counties as well, just across the board for the gorge planning.
Let's go on to 103.
103 is the funding for the second biennium of the 30-year land review task force on land review. Task Force on Land Use Planning. There we go, from Senate Bill 82. You heard testimony on that yesterday. It continues two positions that we have now, and it adds one that we have identified for public outreach. As you heard in testimony yesterday, that is going to be where the task force moves next in the coming months, a significant effort to reach out to Oregonians across the state. And so we want to be able to provide support for that effort. I think if we don't have public input and participation in this, then the prospect of a good reception in the legislature next session will be substantially compromised. And so we think we want to, it's important to validate that effort and provide staff support for that public outreach. A significant part of this also is provision for contract services. As you may know, the task force, well, the department, but on behalf of the task force, has contracted with John Fregonisi and as the lead consultant with a team of consultants just in the last couple of months to work with the task force and is it $600,000, I think, of this package would continue those contract services through the biennium, would basically pay for those consulting services. It sounds like a lot. I would say, Mr. Chair, as you may know from Metro, that's probably less than Metro spends to do a UGB expansion. I may be wrong, but it's we're doing this on the cheap in terms of the effort that is incorporated in a statewide review of the land use planning program. But we have top-notch consultants. John Fregonisi is not only Oregon trained, so he's familiar with the Oregon program. He did do the 2040 effort at Metro, but also in the last several years has worked nationally. I know he did Envision Utah, a major effort in that state. He's working and has done work recently in the city of Dallas, Texas, Denver, and other states and cities across the country. And what's significant about that is it was intentional, I think, on the part of the task force to bring somebody in who has not only experience in the Oregon program and so is conversant in our language and what we do, but also has national experience, on-the-ground experience in what other states and cities are doing to help inform us. We know our program very well, and we think it's pretty good, but we also know that in the last 34 years, the world has not stayed still, but other states have done things, and we think we can learn from those. And so having a consultant that has national exposure and involvement in major planning efforts across the country, I think is critical to the success of the program. It leverages dollars and brings capacity to the 30-year review that we would not be able to provide as a staff at the department, and particularly in that national exposure. And so I strongly support and urge your favorable action on this package to maintain a level of contract services that will provide us the best chance of returning to you in 2 years with a fully developed and credible set of recommendations for this task force. So what you have in this then is I think a pretty minimal level of limited duration staff support, three positions at the department for this statewide effort, contract services with really one of the top consultants, I think, in the nation that we have been fortunate to contract with, and then, of course, support for the task force in being able to move them around the state and to engage in that public outreach that would include not only public meetings, but also we're looking for robust internet and other kinds of outreach efforts to maximize public input to the work of the task force. I don't know much else to say about that other than that we haven't done this in the last 34 years, and we're hoping to conclude in fine fashion in the next biennium, and I would urge legislative support for full funding of this package so that this becomes an effort that we can look back on in 2 years and be glad that we did and didn't short in terms of their need for resources.
Representative Gerard.
Lane, how much funding did Senate Bill 82 authorize?
Mr. Chair, it was $600,000, I believe. We came in last biennium with a request for a little over $900,000. And I think the question that was put to me toward the end of the session, well, what could you do for $600,000? And I said, well, less. But that we would do as much as we could with the understanding that we would hope to catch up in the second biennium. To make up effort to get our full two bienniums worth of work out of this, but it was $600,000.
Chair, just comment. I just have a little problem with this package in that we want the big look to take the big look, and what they do is farm out the big look. And I have a problem with that, although I know it's a common concept for government agencies to farm a study on something. But nonetheless, we're going from 600,000 to doubling that budget for the Big Look Committee to enable them to simply buy a consulting company to tell them what the consulting company is going to tell. That's the concept I'm struggling with.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gard, what I would stress about this is that this is, as we've talked about in the last couple of days, land use planning is complex. And we know our Oregon program. We don't know what the other 50 states are doing. It is not an easy task. And I will tell you, and this is not, I will tell you that you're getting a lot more out of these consulting services with the expertise that they bring to the table based on what they've done around the country already than you would get from funding my positions. On the one hand, I guess as a director, I should say, sure, give me staff. I think that agencies kind of like to fill up another floor of the building or something like that. It makes you feel like you're powerful. I don't want that. I want money that will get us the most bang for our buck, and that really isn't consulting services. This is an area of expertise, and it's not just expertise about land use planning, but it's how to go about a review. Again, these folks have been engaged in Envision Utah. There's a science to how you do this, and we're purchasing some of the best talent in the country. And for this, the $600,000 that would go to contracting services in the next biennium, you are going to get far and above what you would get for that same money if we were to rely on simply department services and staff to be able to do that. We couldn't.
Follow up, and then but if you can't sell this to the legislature in 2009, so far the tab's close to $2 million. I would suspect that you'll need more than the $2 million to finish the job for the Big Look Committee. What's the final tab going to be on something that we don't know is even going to be accepted?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gerard, I think I can answer that. The final tab will be the $600,000 from the current biennium plus whatever you fund for the second biennium, because under Senate Bill 82, the task force's work is done at the end of the coming biennium. So it is not an ongoing commitment or obligation. The expectation is, and in fact Senate Bill 82 says that the final product will be delivered to the 2009 legislative session. That's why I think it's important to put the money into this to get this done, because we won't be back in here in 2 years and say, well, we're almost done, but we need a couple $1 million more for another biennium's work. You would actually have to go back in and really recreate the task force by legislative action in order for us to continue that. So it is a project of finite duration, but I think that also underscores the need to make sure that we give it what it takes to bring back a credible product in 2 years' time.
One follow-up. So you won't be back for more money for Big Look. This is it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gerard, yes. No. I mean, I will not be back. I will not be back for more money for the Big Look. There is no Big Look after the 2007-09 biennium.
Okay. Before I go to Representative Klein, when you said fill up a building and in terms of the impact on that, and I thought about one of our former colleagues, Max Williams, and his filling up a building is probably a different concept.
And Mr. Chair,
I will have Mr. Shetterly's attitude reflected over there. Well, yeah, exactly.
Well, if Max was here, he'd defend himself, saying he doesn't make those decisions. Right. We do.
Mr. Chair, we did ask Director Williams to survey his population to see if he had enough former planners that perhaps we could contract with prison industries, but they don't have
them. As a planner, I take offense
at that. Well, we couldn't find any.
There are going to be a few incarcerated. Representative Klein.
Thank you. My question actually was more on the 3FTE portion, and you mentioned that we're transitioning into a new phase, and so we sort of need another person to do public outreach. My question is the old phase still intact enough that it requires two FTE for that part, or can't one of those people go become the other person?
Mr. Chair, Representative Klim, I would say that the work of the task force is trending up. I mean, this next biennium is going to be more robust, I think, by a substantial degree than the first biennium. I don't see this as a trade-off of moving them out, because the work that they're doing now in terms of the task force meeting monthly, work groups meeting on a weekly basis, when there are six work groups that are meeting in between task force meetings, so they're meeting regularly. That means public notice. That means record minutes being kept. That means archiving everything that these work groups are doing. That's going to continue, and in fact, is going to become more robust in this next biennium. So, no, I don't think it's a matter of saying we're done with this. Let's move this person into a different position. All of that they are doing currently will continue, and then some.
Representative Berlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lynn, ever since Representative Garrard's question about the consultant, I've been sitting here mulling this over. And I guess, you know, when this Big Wolf was put together, and I was pretty active in trying to get one or two folks on there, and, you know, I know, obviously, Gretchen Palmer very well from Bend. It was my impression that the people on the Big Wolf committee were those that worked with the land use system in one way or another, whether they're attorneys or planners. In the case of Gretchen, she's a builder. And I would submit that what I want to hear is their opinions, not some highly paid consultants.
Sure.
Because if the process is so complex that we have to be spending that much money for consultants, I would submit that's the problem. You know, we shouldn't be hiring consultants to work with this thing all the time. So the more I'm thinking about this, the more I'm sharing the same concern about the spending so much money on this consultant.
Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, I guess what I would say is the task force brings the judgment. They bring the on-the-ground truth testing. What they don't have is the knowledge. You know, every one of them is experienced in some aspect. And to be honest, they're not land use experts. These folks that were picked for the task force, it was intentional on the part of the legislature last session and on the part of the speaker, the Senate president, and the governor in picking these task force members to get folks who had experience with some aspect of the land use planning program, but not to go to the folks who populate this building on a biennial basis, who are experts from their own every 2 year battles in the program. And so these folks have the judgment, they have the good common sense to filter what they will be getting from consultants, but what the consultants bring is information, studies, trade-offs, knowledge about what other states have done. We don't have any of that, and I certainly know our 10 members of the task force don't have the capacity to go out and do that kind of literature review and review of studies of what other states have done and the success of those other efforts. That's what we're getting with the consultant. The consultant is bringing information to the task force. I'm sure we'll bring some measure of recommendations, but it's the task force that will exercise their homegrown judgment in terms of what they ultimately approve and bring to the task and bring back to the legislature. They're critical, but they don't have themselves. They're unpaid citizen volunteers. They don't have the capacity to amass the level of research and information that I think is important to make this a credible effort.
Representative Gerard.
It's funny that you expect the legislature to do that, but you don't expect the Big Look Committee to do that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gerard, I guess I would see the Big Look Committee, this whole effort, as being an effort to inform the legislature, so that to the extent that these consultants' services are informing the judgment of the task force, that will have a feedback effect to better inform the legislature. I don't know how better to put that. This is, I think, a good use of dollars to bring information that neither you nor I nor my staff has the ability to bring in 2 years' time. because we do want to make this short term. We want to get to the end of this so that this doesn't become itself another continuing program.
Let me ask a follow-up to that. First of all, I may not share exactly the same concerns, but I have seen both instances. I have seen public bodies that have driven consultants, and I have seen consultants that have driven public bodies. So I think there probably will be some judgment made by the legislature ultimately, you know, how this process is going. And I hope that there would be more reports back to the legislature than simply at the end of the process. But let me ask you the budget question. The budget question is, in this biennium, which is a different set of tasks, how much was paid on consultant services? And in the next biennium for the contract that is planned, how much of that is breakable? Well, you can break up into different chunks and decide if you had less funding, what you could fund and what you might not be able to fund.
Mr. Chair, I think in the current biennium, was it $300,000?
I was going to say $258,000.
Yeah, between $250,000 and $300,000 for consulting services. There was a ramp-up period, of course, to do the initial work of the task force, get the notice out. The consultant has just been on, I think, probably for the last couple of months. Certainly not the full biennium. And so that's really not a in the sense of doubling. We're getting a full biennium's work now, anticipating a full biennium's work out of the consultant. So that's reflected in that cost. The contract, of course, we don't have a contract for the second biennium. It's predicated on funding. So, but what you would, a decision would have to be made in terms of consulting services. If we have less than we think we can, that we need to do a full job, it's going to mean less in the way of product. I mean, it's going to be less in deliverables to the task force. I don't know how to define those in particular chunks. I guess you get what you pay for. And if we have less, and frankly, I suppose there comes a point where the consultant could just say, I'm sorry, we can't do this. That would be the worst case scenario. Otherwise, I guess you get less in the way of literature review and research in terms of what other states have done, less time with the task force to help guide their work and deliberations, less time to assist in the public outreach survey kind of work that the consultant can assist with. It, kind of the same answer I gave 2 years ago. If we have less, we'll get less. And my concern about that is it will compromise the credibility and the value of the work that comes back to the legislature in 2 years. I just don't know how better to say that.
I just remind, just a comment. The legislature was sold on Senate Bill 82 on the basis of a cost of $600,000. And now it's going to be up over $2 million.
Mr. Chair, Representative Girard, that $600,000 was for one biennium, and actually, with the $600,000, it would be about $1.66 million, so it wouldn't be over $2 million. And again, we did come in, at least with a request last session, for about $900 million for the first biennium. So,
$1,000.
I'm sorry. So we are not.
That was your Measure 37.
That's right. We are not out of line with what we at least projected the two biennium cost of the project to be.
Follow-up, Representative Girard or Representative Burley?
Thank you. You keep saying consultants, plural. So the $600,000 is for how many consultants?
Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, the Fregonese firm has I'm trying to think of the names. I don't have the names. There's a consultant that is part of the team from Denver and one from Utah. Again, these are folks that have experience from those states with which John Fregonisi has worked in the past. And then, of course, when I say consultants, these are consulting firms, so they have their own staff. So I'm including those in the package of people that we're getting for this.
The last comment I have on this, Mr. Chair, but I look at this as $300,000 a year to buy information. That's pretty spendy information.
Mr. Chair, if I could just, it's a good discussion. I think what's important and keep in mind about the task force is we have fought the biennial land use wars on the strength of anecdotes for the last 30 years. And what we've lacked in so much of this effort has been solid information. And so we make decisions every 2 years, and even at the commission level, we make decisions on an ongoing basis, on the basis of, you know, of the best information that we have. But again, there hasn't been the concerted effort to get out and dig below anecdote and opinion in this, and that's what we need. We need this information in order to make the best judgments going forward.
I would comment that I don't know what the exact figure is, but my guess is not when we went through the process to do quasi-judicial amendments to the UGB, those are the small amendments, or the line adjustments, which are even smaller, but when we went through actually legislative adjustments of the UGB, legislative decisions, and have extensive internal staff at Metro, and the period of time that was involved in some of those, I would guess that we're in the couple million dollars range for each time we attempt one of those, that process. I think that's why you have there's other legislation in here saying that you need a longer time frame than what we currently have, because all they do is spend time reevaluating the next adjustment for discontinuously. So, well, any closing comments that you want to have?
No, Mr. Chair, this has been fun. I appreciate the
yes, it is.
I enjoyed sitting on that side of the committee tables, and I enjoy the give and take that we have in these hearings. If there's any more information that you feel you need about any of these, particularly the policy option packages, don't hesitate to let us know. We've done our best to give you what we think is a budget that will get us through the next biennium with an emphasis on efficiency and economy and getting the most for the dollars we have asked for. I commend it to you and look forward to your favorable action. Subject only, of course, to whatever we find will be the world for us in Measure 37 after whatever action the legislature takes this biennial this session.
Mr. Shadowy, thank you for responding to everything here. I do not know when the co-chairs will give me the okay to run your budget. But with that, I think we are concluded for today, and we will be here tomorrow for water resources.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of